Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, July 11th, 2018. We begin with the news section, the Justice League. Judicial candidates used to eschew ideology in favor of generic rhetoric about fairness and impartiality. Not this year, not in Durham. 6 years ago, Paul Newby, a Supreme Court justice seeking re-election in the state's highest court, became lodged in the public's mind via a political action committee ad with a catchy banjo tune. Paul Newby, justice tough but fair. Paul Newby, criminals best beware. The banjo player repeated with a twang. Kitsch aside, the ad summed up what has been the traditional judicial campaign message: experience, firmness, and an even hand. Not this year, at least in Durham. With elections coming up in November, judicial challengers are emphasizing their experience and pledging to be fair and hold people accountable. But they're also talking about things like bail reform, diverting people from the courts to begin with, and helping people who do go through the system emerge productive and healthy. Thomas Mills, a longtime political consultant whose father was a judge, says the ideological messaging is certainly out of the mainstream for a job typically associated with impartiality and restraint. Normally, the topics are not issue-oriented, he said. They're more about the personal character that people bring to the job: experience, integrity, fairness, impartiality, those types of things. I think it's reflective of the time. We've created really what's an activist society in some ways. There's a desire for change in the way government works, top to bottom, and the activists are on both sides of the aisle. Perry Woods, another local political consultant, isn't surprised that such reform-minded candidates would come out of Durham. It's not something they necessarily often do, but in this environment, it doesn't necessarily surprise me, he said, pointing to the rise of movements like Black Lives Matter. Last year, legislators voted to again make races for district and Superior Court seats partisan. They also canceled judicial primaries over the objections of Democrats. District court judges are elected to 4-year terms, while Superior Court judges are in office for 8 years. The race for one Superior Court seat in Durham's district, currently held by Elaine O'Neill, who isn't seeking re-election after being named interim dean of NC Central's law school, is contested. In that race, Assistant District Attorney Josephine Kerr Davis faces Dawn Baxton, Senior Assistant Public Defender for the county. Incumbents are unopposed for two other Superior Court seats. Chief Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson is not up for re-election this year. 6 district court seats are on the ballot, with incumbents unopposed in 4 of them. Clayton Jones, an assistant district attorney and former public defender, is taking on Chief District Court Judge James Hill, the only Republican out of the Durham candidates, and a 16-year incumbent. Dave Hall, a civil rights attorney, is challenging Judge Fred Battaglia, who was elected in 2014. Battaglia was in the spotlight earlier this year after acquitting 3 people accusing of topping a Confederate monument. He later suggested to members of the County Republican Party that the prosecution had dropped the ball. Their candidacies came after Durham voters elected an avowedly progressive city council made up mostly of women of color, a new sheriff pledging to cut ties with immigration and customs enforcement and build trust with the communities of color, and a new district attorney who most recently ran an affordable housing advocacy organization and campaigned on many of the same values echoed by this crop of judicial candidates. A Durham native, Deus, has practiced law for more than 15 years, including as an assistant public defender in Fayetteville and an assistant attorney general with the State Department of Justice. Through her work, she's seen firsthand how justice is rendered upon what you have. As a mother of two children, two African-American boys, I don't want them to have to deal with a system that's based on chance and what type of opportunities they have, she says. She realized she had become a part of that fragmented system. As an ADA, by treating everyone equally rather than according for their different circumstances. David wants to bring her perspective as a black woman and working mother not only to the bench in Durham, but also to other counties where Superior Court judges rotate. What I recognize is there are mothers who are aching because they lost their son or daughter to violent offenses, she says. But also there are mothers who are aching because their sons are looking at 20, 25 years, maybe even life sentences. If elected, Davis said she would seek a revision of Durham County's bond guidelines, which were written in 2011 by the Chief Superior and District Court judges, in an effort to see secured bonds set for fewer nonviolent crimes. She would also like to set up a diversion court to deal solely with crimes driven by poverty. I don't have a platform where I'm tough on crime, she said. I have a platform about accountability and mercy. Paxton grew up in the tiny coastal town of Roper, North Carolina. She knew from a young age, about 13, that she wanted to be an attorney. With few models around, she looked to Thurgood Marshall, the first African-American U.S. Supreme Court justice who, as a lawyer, helped undo Jim Crow. Her ideas about what it meant to be a fair judge are rooted in her experience being raised by grandparents with limited means, being a first-generation college graduate, and representing indigent clients. A lot of judges say they're going to be fair, but they don't tell you exactly what fair means to them. Fair for me always means being forthright, she said. Also for me, fair means making sure everybody has the same access to justice, because that's the only way the system works. Paxton has worked as an assistant public defender in Durham County since 1999 and has been second to the chief defender since 2006. She says she and her colleagues at the public defender's office have long seen bond as an issue of fairness for their clients. It's important because in order for them to actually realize their right to fair trial, they need the ability to be out and help their lawyer prepare a fair trial, she said. We understand the need to have a bond set that's going to protect the community, but we also believe you're innocent until proven guilty. Jones spent 13 years with the public defender's office in Durham before becoming an assistant district attorney in 2016. As a judge, he said he would be proactive in trying to reduce the burden of fines and fees on the accused. Fines, fees, and costs shouldn't be a hindrance for working people who are trying to live their life and survive, he said. He would also like to see drug court and mental health court programs expanded, giving people more opportunities to avoid jail, more interpreters at the courthouse, and the bail system overhauled to assign secured bonds in fewer nonviolent cases. Depriving someone's liberty should be the remedy of last resort, he said. It seems like in the system we have now, we incarcerate first. We incarcerate over mental health issues. We incarcerate for substance abuse issues. We incarcerate if you don't have money. Jones is taking on a longtime incumbent who has campaigned in the past with the tried and true message of impartiality. Jones says Durham judges can be more actively involved in achieving the kind of reform voters signaled they wanted in the recent elections. I'm not saying everything has to be completely overhauled, but for me, I've seen inequalities I feel I could address better, he said. I think we could have a better bench going in the direction of change than we have in Durham. Hall is the least conventional of the four challengers. Most recently, he was a civil rights attorney with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, working on issues like bail reform, expungements, and racially disparate policing. That work has helped him understand the impact of courts on people's lives. Now, he says, he wants to change the system from within. We certainly, in the election for DA, embraced a whole new set of values around criminal justice reform. And I think I certainly played a role in shaping the narrative of criminal justice reform in Durham. His own ideas about safety evolved when, in 2013, he was struck by a stray bullet in a shootout on his street, and he started thinking about why those shots were fired in the first place. Safety for me looks like stopping punishing folks for having been through the system, he said. We have a societal addiction to punishment, and we need to have some culture shift around that mindset. To that end, Hall says as a judge, he would look for opportunities to use restorative justice in sentences and divert people from the system. He also believes the bail system is inequitable and needs to take into account what people can afford. A lot of damage can be done by district court holding people in jail so that by the end of the month, when their rent is due, a 2 or 3 day dip could mean everything to somebody, he said. It could mean the loss of their work, their place to live, their children in some cases. The court needs to be flexible, and the court needs to understand what really happens in folks' lives after they leave that courtroom. Now to the Indy Food section. After the flood, come hell or high water, for its staff and customers, iconic Durham restaurant Nana's was a force of nature. A longtime bartender pays honor to its culture on its final night. By the time final toasts were made by Nana's following its last night of service on June 30th, the calendar had rolled into July. The dozens of late-night revelers in their bar were a mix of present and past employees whose years of service stretched in a near-continuous timeline all the way back to the restaurant's opening in 1992. Friends and spouses, some of whom were customers before they were friends and spouses. Several tearful regulars, and a fair number of people no one had ever seen before. That was Nana's. It was a complex, extended family whose members never really left, not even after their lives called them away and shared in its lifeblood, whether they were on the payroll or on the reservations list or living on other continents. And the place easily and freely folded its newcomers, right up to the very end, an end no one thought would ever come. It's hard to ponder life without Nana's. I worked at Nana's for 12 years, which was only the fifth longest tenure in the restaurant's history. Sixth, of course, if you count chef owner Scott Howell. I returned for the hectic final week of service, along with other Nana's vets, to lend a hand. One of them, who was among the few who surpassed me in tenure, was Brad Wellington, Nana's longtime bartender, who, with his brother Graham, now co-owns one of its surviving siblings, Nana Steak. Brad raised his glass and allowed that, although its food was what brought people to Nana's, it wasn't why they came back. Nana's, he said, was a culture. To some, that culture could seem insular, even clubby. It was true that you saw the same faces there year after year, but membership was unrestricted and easy to gain. Show up once, then show up again. And the perception that Nana's was elitist had no basis. By the time it closed, it was no longer anything like Durham's most expensive restaurant, if it ever was, and its portions were almost cartoonishly large compared to similarly priced places. The millionaires and ballers and surgeons and lawyers who populated the place were far outnumbered by schoolteachers, librarians, salespeople, and thousands of other ordinary folks who were treated no less royally. In fact, it didn't matter who you were, as long as you were authentically yourself, because Nana's was always authentically Nana's. Fully, unmistakably, unapologetically. And it asked the same of its clientele. Scott may have sometimes lost his way, as he told the News and Observer in 2016, reflecting on the Kitchen accident that nearly killed him and his subsequent addiction, depression, and hospitalization. But he never lost the way of which Nana's, which qualified as fine dining of a kind that is leaving the world with little fanfare. Scott didn't like the category anyway, at least not when he described his restaurant, which seldom put on airs. He had an unerring pretension detector, both on the menu and in the dining room. Only what was real endured. The realness was what gave Nana's its staying power. It was a force of nature, sometimes a brute one, like the notorious floods that overwhelmed it every year or so. Nana's was built in front of a creek and over a culvert that is prone to catastrophic overflow. But the place sailed on, come hell or literally high water, floorboards warping, funds leaking, someone in the kitchen stirring Nana's famous risotto. Regulars came and went and died of old age, their tables taken by new regulars for whom the place seemed just as indispensable. Nana's inspired an almost pathological loyalty. And no wonder. Scott is pathological, as any restaurateur must be. That's not a value judgment. It's a verdict of sympathy. Plenty of people, including Scott himself, have called him worse. In any case, Scott's restaurant was more beloved than he is, and its legacy exceeds him and his food. It's the inimitable singular culture Weddington identified. That culture carried a strain of craziness that was essential to working at Nana's as taking orders, cooking food, and wading into chest-high floodwaters with an axe. Don't ask about that. Working with Scott, you saw that to win, you don't outrun your demons or overcome them. You put them to work in service to your dreams. You put yourself in service, too. I saw Scott sacrifice his health, wealth, and some personal relationships to keep the place alive, even when it tried to kill him. And not just in the form of the monster grill that fell on him in 2013. Nana's, of course, chugged on without him. Accidents and floods are what makes the news. A restaurant can crush or drown you every single day, and no renowned career chefs are as genial, reasonable, even-keeled, or well-adjusted. It's never nice all the time, Scott said during his final toast, understating the case by 1,000 pounds. If it was nice all the time, then anybody could do it. Hardly anyone can. There's an episode of MASH in which an internal army evaluator is sent to the 4077, the hospital unit number, with instructions to build a case for breaking up its motley crew of louche infighting malcontents under Colonel Blake's erratic leadership. The evaluator observes textbook examples of neuroses, psychoses, voyeurism, fetishism, and a few isms I've never even heard of. They're mad, quite mad, he said. But when an especially gruesome flight of wounded soldiers comes in, he watches the entire unit labor intensively, professionally, and harmoniously to save them. Hours later, he concludes, awestruck, they're impossible people in an impossible place doing totally impossible work. And the only act I can think of that would be madder still would be to break them up. To many, it seemed mad to break up Nana's, which was as popular as ever after 25 years. But madness has always been Scott's method. The reasons are many and knotty. But in the end, the restaurant closed for the same reason it stayed open so long, because Scott wanted it to. As he spoke on the final night, sometimes through tears, his resolve was audible in his voice, his humor visible in his clothing. He was wearing pink shorts and a black faux snakeskin jacket, whose lining was entirely silkscreened with portraits of Elvis. It was the only time I'd ever seen him wear anything so outlandish, and it was appropriate for the night he left the building. He thanked his staff generously, graciously, and then concluded with a final few words. People knew that we cared about them. It wasn't just about us, it was about them. That was the biggest thing we did. It was a privilege for us to have people here. We didn't treat it like it was a privilege for them to be here. That's why we won. Nana's closed 6 years after Magnolia Grill, its seminal fine dining cousin. Their quarter-century lifespans were nearly identical. They're forever linked in local culinary history. Scott cooked at Magnolia before opening Nana's, and their lineage dominates our culinary present. Unlike Magnolia's Ben Barker, though, Scott isn't retiring. He has new projects already underway. The culture lives on, but there's no successor to Nana's. An era has ended. Durham, Weddington said, will never be the same. Now from the indie music section, Home Fires Burning. Arcade Fire's story as indie rock titans began a decade and a half ago at a tiny triangle club. On June 7th, 2004, a typical Monday night, Arcade Fire played a set at The Cave. As the story goes in Our Noise, John Cook's written history of Merge Records, the hastily booked gig at Chapel Hill's favorite 74-capacity venue occurred in the middle of Arcade Fire's first U.S. tour. Though they had already played a number of undersold American shows, the band had scored a reliable opportunity opening for the short-lived Montreal Bizarro indie rock outfit, the Unicorns. This was the early aughts, and the Unicorns were themselves riding a wave of pre-analytics internet hype, and will they implode, speculation month before Arcade Fire's debut LP, Funeral, would define that trend. In a twist, the Unicorns, long since imploded, would reunite to open for Arcade Fire in 2014 on their friends' 15,000-seat arena tour. Why exactly did Arcade Fire play The Cave? Moreover, how did an art rock band from Montreal end up inextricably connected to the Triangle? Credit their longtime label, the Durham-based Merge, and a man named Howard Billerman. Billerman is a longtime friend of Merge co-founder Mac McGowan. He briefly drummed for Arcade Fire for about a year prior to Funeral's September 2004 release, and currently co-runs the Hotel 2 Tango studio in Montreal with members of Godspeed You, Black Emperor. He was also the linchpin between Arcade Fire and Merge. Though sweating about his personal connections to the band, he mailed the label a DVD of live footage, which turned out to be improperly burned. He then offered a CD of demo material that hung around the office for a while. As Cook documented in Our Noise, McCowan and the rest of the staff loved the music when they eventually got to it. They also famously dragged their feet to respond. In that interim, Arcade Fire signed to Alien 8, a Canadian experimental label known at the time for issuing oddball records by Mertzbaugh, Keiji Hino, and Masana. McCowan sent an email expressing interest the day that the band went out for a celebratory deal dinner. Naturally, that created some tension. but the labels and the band resolved it more or less amicably. Still, the incident meant that booking a show in North Carolina, where Merge could see them, was likely important as a show of commitment on all sides. It was like seeing U2 on the war tour when I was 15, McCowan said, after the show in the Pop Matters piece in 2007. They had these huge anthems that the crowd was responding to right away, even though no one had heard the songs yet. Just a month later, Arcade Fire returned to play a megafest pre-party at Local 506 with Savala's Lou Barlow, just before the release of Funeral. Footage on YouTube, shot by Chapel Hill videographer Cam Carithers, who was working on a DVD for Merge at the time, shows the band fiercely ripping through their set, barely able to fit even their slightest downsized lineup on the tiny stage. Carithers also taped an interview with the band, which is some of the earliest video footage of the group. We filmed this sort of thing with them in the green room of 506, just them talking while eating celery and burrito chips. It was meant to be an MTV-style intro to the performance video, he recalls, but at the time Carithers wasn't convinced they'd go so far. I liked them, but even at that show, they were like any other new Merge band. Everyone in the know was like, "You have to check this band out. They have so much energy," because they were Merge's latest signing. I never assumed they would be bigger than Neutral Milk Hotel or Superchunk or the biggest things on the label, he said. Fast forward 14 years. Arcade Fire is returning to play Red Hat Amphitheater in Raleigh on July 12th. Frontman Wynn Butler is spinning records at Motoko in Durham at the night before as DJ Windows 98. This is their first official return, coming back into the Triangle after almost a decade. Arcade Fire's latest show here was a May 2008 rally for Barack Obama's presidential campaign in the Carborough Town Commons. The band was just off the Neon Bible Tour, and George W. Bush was still in office. The gap seems especially strange when you consider the length of the time and the band's run on Merge within those years. Funeral dropped to ravenous acclaim, well outstripping the initial 10,000-copy print that Merge ordered. In 2007, Neon Bible galvanized Arcade Fire's status as the indie band du jour, and kept Merge's name hot to a new generation of indie rock fans, not to mention the burgeoning mainstream crossover indie movement. A few years later, the suburbs boxed out Eminem, Lady Gaga, Katy Perry, and Lady Antebellum to win 2011's Album of the Year Grammy. Their rise is the stuff of rock legend. And yet, Arcade Fire never publicly returned to the area that signed them or put out those records. For years in the middle 20s, the top Google result of Arcade Fire North Carolina was a news article about an actual boardwalk Arcade Fire at the Carolina Beach. Why not come back to play a festival like Hopscotch or one of Merge's anniversary events like 2014's Merge 25? Chalk it up to financial incentives, large-scale venues, and other logistics that aren't easy to overcome in the Triangle, as well as a vast and likely boring world of internal music industry politics. Their record deal with Merge was characterized in the press as loose and hands-off, with the band and the label splitting profits and Arcade Fire otherwise handling all their own recording, licensing, production, decisions, and tour routing, with little input from Merge. It feels like a safe bet that playing the home state of their label wouldn't register high for a band of their pedigree, especially once the band quietly shifted over to Columbia Records. Arcade Fire's return to the Triangle may be much delayed, and the occasion is a tidy benchmark for the status of local and international institutions alike. Who knew that a small one-off show in a college town could make such a difference. In a section entitled Music Brief, Independent Venue Week comes to Motoko. This week, 14 venues across the country, including Durham's Motoko Music Hall, are painstaking in their stateside debut of Independent Venue Week, which runs July 9th to the 15th, billed as Record Store Day for Venues. It's designed to commemorate independently run music venues through a series of shows, spotlighting smaller clubs, and giving them the chance to build relationships with new patrons, artists, labels, promoters, and media. It's a first step, but I'm a believer that venues should try to work together, as I think there are a lot of benefits to be had if we do, says Glenn Booth, a former owner of Local 506, who now works at Motoko's marketing director. IVW helps highlight that, although we are locally owned and operated, we're not alone in this pursuit to bring great artists to our local communities. Independent venues benefit artists, fans, and the industries at large, fostering an environment where talent can flourish without big money backings from major labels or promoters like Live Nation Lines. To Booth, Motoko's participation in IVW could get its name circulating outside the state while elevating its local presence. We wanted to participate in both highlight and bring a focus on the need for independent venues as well as being highlighted. It's nice to be part of the event that includes nationally renowned venues like Washington, D.C.'s 930 Club. Though IVW runs for 7 days, it only manifests as an individual show for participating venues. For Motoko, that show is with River Wilds, a folk band from Asheville. Although we weren't limited to doing this while a local act, we're hoping that we could use this event to highlight a solid local artist that people outside of North Carolina may have heard of also. Featured artists in other venues around the county include The Lone Bellow, The Get Up Kids, and Western Medication. The IVW concept began in the UK, and its fifth edition there this year boasted a tenfold increase in participating venues. We hope we can expand in the U.S. in the same way, says IVW's Civil Bell in a statement. It sets the scene to make this a true celebration of venues globally over the coming years. Also from the indie music section, Ties That Bind. Felix Obelus Wendy Spitzer was a diehard solo artist, but a transformative time abroad taught her to play well with others. Wendy Spitzer asked questions about the things that everyone experiences but nobody talks about. How do we make friends in adulthood versus other parts of our lives? How do we work together? And how do emotional issues arise and get resolved when we're collaborating? She doesn't offer answers, but since returning to the Triangle after a years-long stint abroad, the longtime local musician has been probing their possibilities. Spitzer spent 2015 to 2016 at Goldsmiths University of London, delving into these questions of trust, vulnerability, and the social dynamic inherent in creative collaboration, while earning her master's degree in music. Before that, she spent a year living alone in Prague, and prior to that, she was in Carborough, making music under the name Felix Obelisks, a name that intentionally has no meaning, allowing its function to remain fluid. It doesn't connote any one particular thing other than the words sound nice together, Spitzer said. Felix Obelisk has changed over time, and it's always in flux. Initially, it was a band that I put together to play my own music, which I used to write myself, and everyone just played all the parts. Over time, it morphed into more of a solo project, where basically me as a musician is Felix Obelix. Though Spitzer considers herself primarily a musician, a composer, a singer, and a multi-instrumentalist whose work is an experimental blend of classical and pop styles, she's spent the past few years dabbling in other arenas, ranging from visual art to creative writing. People have told me that there's a strong current of myself going through everything that I do, regardless of media, she said. Recently, however, Spitzer has become less interested in her personal brand and more interested in creative collaborations. I'm not playing strictly Felix Obelix music right now, where everything is my own vision, because I'm really interested in what happens when it's me plus other people, Spitzer said. People bring out different things in each other. This intrigue goes back to her time spent in London researching psychosocial dimensions of interacting with other persons in a creative setting. Spitzer's newfound interest in creative collaboration stems from multiple sources. After having done my music for so long, I was ready for a change, she said. I think the isolation of living in a different country by myself was also at play. Another catalyst for Spitzer's research was the unexpected death of a friend and musical associate. His death hit me hard, really hard, and I was really surprised by it. So I started to think, why is this affecting me so much? I got back to that thing of, like, we were doing special musical things together, so it was like a double loss as a friend and as a collaborator. And then I started thinking about why that relationship was so special and interesting. Spitzer's research explores how vulnerability in social relationships leads to trust. And when this occurs in a creative collaboration, the social dynamic deepens in parallel with the artwork. It creates what this scholar Vera Johnson calls emotional scaffolding. It's like you're building a building, and the other person builds the scaffolding so you can get higher and higher and finish the building. It creates a framework where you feel safe enough to try new things and take risks, which you can't always get when you're doing your own thing. But those connections can go the other way too, Spitzer notes. It's a relationship between collaborators. If that relationship is unhealthy, their art suffers too. Trusting each other's feedback is one of the most important elements of maintaining positivity within a creative collaboration. You can have an internal, external, objective, subjective opinion about how it's going. It's a very special thing if you can find collaborators that are really in tune with you, Spitzer said. And she has, as an outgrowth of her findings. Spitzer is involved in numerous creative collaborations, five of which she plans to showcase in a performance called Co-Laboratory at Nightlife at Saturday. I'm going to start off by giving a conference presentation on my research, which is not a typical way to start a rock show. But who cares, Spitzer said. Then I'm going to Skype in my collaborator, Barnes Ploffley, in the UK. And we're going to play music over the speakers, which we've been writing remotely, trading files back and forth. Spitzer and Ploffley's crisp, evocative compositions fall under the genre of library music, intended for use in videos, commercials, podcasts. Following that, Spitzer and Genevieve Dawson will perform songs they've written together, after which Spitzer will screen a documentary art project she created with her friend Carol Bales on the topic of friendship. Yet another set involves Spitzer and her partner Billy Sugarfix, reading from the first draft of a middle-grade novel they're writing about a boy's journey through seventh grade, inspired by Sugarfix's own experience. It's basically about a kid who has a Napoleon complex and is trying to compensate for being small for his age in a number of ways, and finds that he really wants to play rock music, Sugarfix says, adding that the creative collaboration process with Spitzer has helped him refine the narrative. Since it's about my experience, I want to write about everything, but Wendy can look and tell if it adds anything to the plot or if it's just some silly story. If she rewrites a scene that I wrote, it's like the scene got bitten by a spider with powers, Sugarfix says. Co-laboratori will conclude with a set of songs performed by Jazeele Pete, a band comprising Spicer, cellist Josh Starmer, and percussionist Robert Cantrell. I feel like, especially in this creative area, the triangle itself, there's a lot of collaborating going on, Spicer says. I like to pick questions about things that people aren't talking about, and having a chance to have a whole night around that topic, first with a presentation, and then getting to witness the outcomes. People will get to think about these ideas in a new kind of new way. And now from the indie stage section, show business. Chester Turnau attempts the impossible, an economically viable performance experiment that promotes freedom and flexibility. The choreographer, Justin Turnau, recently walked me through the fruit's seemingly unending cavernous rooms, describing the similarly proportioned scope of her newest work. Distilling all the layers of Show, a collaborative cross-disciplinary project that will inhabit the space for 5 nights this week, is impossible, and necessarily so. The work comes together anew each night and leaves several elements to chance. But I'll try. During the first half of Show, attendees will be able to explore with control and agency, videographer Alex Manis says, several rooms housing art installations and artists working in response to certain themes, absence and presence, visibility and invisibility. In the second half, company dancers will perform in the fruit's pillared space. Throughout, subtle and overt mechanisms, including video surveillance, will invert the conventional separation between audience and audience. The whole thing, Turnau explains, is meant to feel a bit like a museum, albeit one that centers on performance work and the presence of everyone. We now turn to the indie stage section. Show business. Justin Turnau attempts the impossible, an economically viable performance experiment that promotes freedom and flexibility. The choreographer, Justin Turnau, recently walked me through the fruit's seemingly unending cavernous rooms, describing the similarly proportioned scope of her newest work, distilling all the layers of Show, a collaborative cross-disciplinary project that will inhabit the space for 5 nights this week, and it's impossible and necessarily that it be able to be done, described. The work comes together anew each night and leaves several elements to chance, but I'll try. During the first half of Show, attendees will be able to explore with control and agency, videographer Alex Manis says, several rooms housing art installations and artists working in response to certain themes, absence and presence, visibility and invisibility. In the second half, company dancers will perform in the fruit's pillared space. Throughout, subtle and overt mechanisms, including video surveillance, will invert the conventional separation between artist and audience. The whole thing, Turnau explains, is meant to feel a bit like a museum, albeit one that centers on performance work and the presence of everyone inhabiting that space. There's a lot about performance, or at least choreography, that can feel withheld, like there's some kind of hidden meaning. I'm really not about that, Turnau says. If audiences just look and listen and feel whatever they feel and think what they think, that's what we want. Show is Turnau, Manis, and visual artist Heather Gordon's latest large-scale collaboration for several performers following last summer's multimedia extravaganza, Number 19 Modulations. Greensboro-based lighting designer Chris Fleming is the fourth principal collaborator in Show, It's also Torno's first work for company since she spent more than a month last fall as an artist-in-residence at Tanzart Atelier in Kirchau, Germany, where she developed Number 22 Penumbra, a performance in conjunction with Gordon's exhibit, And Then the Sun Swallowed Me at Cam Raleigh last February. In Europe, Turno had time to get mad about the state of arts funding in the U.S., about how art making seems inseparable from capitalistic assignments of monetary value, even for independent artists like her, who rely on local economic buy-in. These concerns are taking on more weight as development spirals out of control in Durham. Turno has used crowdfunding not only to partly pay for show, but also to call attention to the minimum production cost, $12,000, for a work on this scale. These issues are particularly urgent in performance, where tradition strategies of documentation and funding, which Gordon points out, more easily apply to concrete objects like a painting, are not always viable. The conundrum relates to the relationship between performance and audience. Does one necessitate the other? I have a tricky relationship with spectatorship and what it means to perform, Turnow said. I'm interested in performance as research instead of just performance for others, a way that performance can be valued as an internal experience for the performers as much as an external experience for the person witnessing. This line of thinking runs through show. On one hand, there's the richness of all that will happen inside the Fruit's many rooms, what we could call the piece's content. In one room, a light installation by Kai Rydell and Sean Thagan plays with progressive dimming and shock light brightening. In another, several well-known local artists examine the prompt absence and presence. In the second half, company works through Turno's signature angular phrasings in a rectangular bounded by scrims that will incorporate Manis's surveillance footage. On the other hand, show uses content to redirect attention to context in the frames that enclose the work, walls, lighting, sound, score. How do these elements make a performance possible, and even encourage open-mindedness about what performance is? Turno says, the Fruit is the only source, there's only space, where they could make multiple large-scale installations, thanks to its large footprint and owner Jim Walter's openness. In being deeply customizable, the Fruit allows the audience to experience what show could be and not have a fixed idea about it, Turno says. In a way, then, this is a work about possibility, how a set of discrete structural conditions actually creates more options for performance and audience members. Turno's M.O. is to create a structure that promotes a maximum amount of freedom, which is reflected in her trust in her collaborators, a company hallmark, and a nod to the influence of Merce Cunningham and John Cage. This approach resonates with Turno's aim to empower audience members to feel their own agency, to examine how their presence contributes to show. But how can show's conceptual rigor extend beyond the five-night run? It will be video documented each night, and ultimately a public website will provide links to all the participating artists' work. The key lies in its porosity, its potential to unleash its energies elsewhere. Turno and Gordon want to develop a manual that documents show's concrete technical elements, a sprung floor bounded by scrim, a room with down spotlights, and so on. This manual could be distributed to like-minded artists in other communities, Gordon says, allowing others to replicate show's conditions while filling in the content according to their own interests. It is an innovative artistic model one that expands a creative vision outward while tethering it to the show's unique iteration in Durham. And it's one we should pay a particular attention to as independent artists in the Triangle and elsewhere as they look for creative paths toward building solidarity, as well as to present, document, and advance their work. This is what I've dreamed of, what I think is interesting inside the scrim box, Tarnow says. But if I said absence and presence to another group of people in a different part of the world, what would they do with it? Then she rephrases the question slightly. What could they do with it? Now from the indie art section, Monster Mash. Antoine Williams brutally charts the distorting effects on the body of structural racism and forced dysfunction. Antoine Williams makes monsters, except they're not monsters, they're us. The hybrid half-animal figures that populate his collage paintings are warped by generations of structural racism and express the trauma of forced dysfunction. But there's hope within the horror, new abilities that emerge from the distortion as William figures adapt to survive it. Williams' exhibit, Kidnapped Pagans, debuted in Charlotte on a grand scale last year, shown in the Mint Museum, as well as in the public spaces on kiosks and the sides of buildings. Independent curator Jonelle Logan organized that show, as well as this iteration, in Raleigh. At Anchor Light, the show occupies two disconnected galleries. The front gallery features many recent paintings with the Chapel Hill-based artist's distinctive distressed surfaces and layering of collage and drawing. An inner gallery features an installation of 9 life-size figures in profile, wheat pasted around 3 walls in the room of a kind of procession under duress. The substrate of Williams' paintings is a layered collage of color washes, often in the pinks and greens of vintage house paint, and a collage of newspaper and magazine pages that he sands, peels, and paints on. Despite the violence of these processes, the surfaces are oddly static, an image of conflict sustained over time until it becomes daily life. William draws animal-human hybrid characters on top of that surface. One of his long-standing recurring characters, and a kind of anti-hero within his oeuvre, is a man with sagging pants, no arms, and apparent chicken legs jutting straight up in the place of a head. In his show, William's characterization has grown more sophisticated and expressionist. In one work, the figure stands among chickens that have arms for the back halves of their bodies. Bodies burst and dematerialize into splatters and scrawls. Knife and Wound is the most spectacular image in the first gallery, containing a figure in the corner whose torso explodes into a cloud of scarred signification, including tufts of feathers and fur, horns, teeth, and a single-shaped needle thumb. The cloud terminates in the figure torso, headless, with its hands folded behind its head, as if commanded to freeze by a cop. Collage pages have been peeled off, leaving rectangulars of underpainting to show the removal, giving the overall impression of a U.S. map, traumatized, internally erupting. The contents of the second gallery are stark compared to the colors and layers of the first, which makes the dehumanization of black subjects as animals and products more chilling. Hand-drawn figures in black and white proceed around the room's perimeter in profile, most of them variations on a hoodie-wearing figure. They are humanoid, with animal protrusions on their heads and backs. Crocodile sparks or a rhinoceros horn tear through the hoodie's fabric. On a few, the drawstrings become antenna or tentacles. Some of the protrusions, however, are cultural, not animal. One figure with a shark's face has Crisco cans protruding from its back. On the only apparent female figure, a cluster of long swords jab out of the head. Everyone is crippled and corrupted. A trio on the room's long wall seemed to be running, fleeing pursuers or from an attack. Along another wall, they're hunched and stopped, exhausted or frozen in the pain of transformation. At the front of procession, a male-female pair is led by a recurring figure sitting on a toy car, dressed in Superman pajamas, with a holster pistol on his hip. A tear in the paper splits his head in half and removes his eyes. The torn child is terrifying. It might have been an image of joy in its original form, a kid having fun with a toy, but the missing eyes make the face emotionally unreadable, the open mouth a shout of pain or loss. Still, the boy is armed. The backs and head of these figures are armored and weaponized. Survivors, they are hybridized into the necessity of their condition. Adaptation is mutation, after all. Looking at these figures, it seems inevitable that Williams will expand into sculpture at some point. Imagine them as three-dimensional figures stalking and fleeing around you in a public space like a park or a city square, or perhaps surrounding Silent Sam at UNC, where Williams got an MFA, and you'll shudder with their power and gravity. If we are all monsters, some of us have to evolve by necessity, and others by choice. Some performance information on the last articles read. Wendy Spitzer's Co-Laboratory will appear Saturday, July 14th at 9 p.m., cost $7, at the Nightlight in Chapel Hill, www.nightlightclub.com. Justin Turneau's piece will be appearing Wednesday, July 11th, to Sunday, July 15th, 8 p.m., cost $15 to $20, at The Fruit in Durham, www.durhamfruit.com. And the Monster Mash Anton Williams Kidnap Pagans through Saturday, August 4th, at the Anchor Light in Raleigh, www.anchorlightraleigh.com. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.